Welcome to The Watchman, your weekly one-hour expose on Bible prophecy and everything you need to know about the times in which we live, because the coming of the Lord is sooner than you think.
Good evening and welcome to The Watchman. As we continue our study of the book of Revelation, we've been through the first five chapters. We spoke about the church age, we spoke about Revelation, the introduction of the book. We spoke about the church ages. Last time we dealt with chapters 4 and 5, which talk about the worship in heaven. And I went into so many other things, like the judgment of God, the judgment seat of Christ. I also spoke a bit about the great white throne judgment, which we shall speak about later on when we are dealing with the final chapters of Revelations 19-20. And so we continue now with the study, and now we're going into chapter 6. Thank you so much for joining and listening to this message, and I hope you are really being blessed by what is being discussed here as we come to terms with the fact that we are living in the last days, and we really are closer to the coming of the Lord than so many people think. Now, if you doubt that, you're going to know that from this lesson, if you haven't already known that from previous lessons. We now must be going in like our 20th lesson since the program started. Now, I'll read from Revelation chapter 6, and I'll start with the first verse. Now, I saw the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he went out conquering and to conquer. It's interesting, he had a bow, but he did not have an arrow, just a bow. Then the second, verse 3 said, talking about now the second seal. Now that was the first seal, a white horse. Okay, all these are four horses. The second seal, then he opened the second seal. I had the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out. And it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. Okay? Just take note of this. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Now, what's the meaning of this? The oil and the wine, a quart of wheat. Now, a quart of wheat is a measure that is still used up to today. Okay, and it actually at the time referred to enough wheat for a day's meal, so enough food for a day, and for a denarius. Now, a denarius amounts to about the wages of a laborer for a day. So that means laborers working for enough food for the day. A quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius. Do not harm the oil and the wine. Remember those, because I'm going to explain what they mean. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death. And Hades followed him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth, to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. Now, these are the first four seals, representing four horses. The first is white, the second is red, the third is black, and the fourth is pale, is a pale horse, as it is interpreted there. Now, when you read things like this, and I mean four horses, people riding on it, so what does that mean? What's the meaning of it? Now, when you read something like that in the books of prophecy, and it does not make any sense, search for it somewhere else in the Bible. Because prophecy is made in such a way that all the things that we come and interpret are from very many different books, from Daniel, from Ezekiel, from Zechariah, from the epistles, from the Gospels, from the book of Revelation, from 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians. So there must be something similar elsewhere that kind of gives you a clue of what these four horses are. So if you read Zechariah chapter 6, starting from the first verse, That's where you see all these things. Then I turned and raised my eyes and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were mountains of bronze. Now that's interesting, mountains of bronze. Four chariots. Now in Revelation it's talking about four horses. Here it's talking about four chariots. With the first chariot were red horses. Okay? The second one black. The third one white. It's the same colors as in Revelation, only the order has been changed a little. And the fourth was dappled horses, which strong steeds, which really means the same as what was interpreted as pale horses in the book of Revelations. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my Lord?" And the angel answered and said to me, "These are four spirits of heaven." And by heaven, it does not mean heaven where God's throne is. It means, it can mean the heavenlies. Okay? These are the, which does not necessarily mean where God's throne is. These are the four spirits of heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. The one with the black horses is going to the north country. Remember, this is from where this is spoken. He's going to the north country. The white are going after them. And the dappled are going towards the south country. Then the strong steeds, or the strong horses, went out eager to go, that they might walk to and fro the earth. And he said, "Go, walk to and fro throughout the earth." So they walked to and fro throughout the earth. And he called to me and spoke to me, saying, "These who go to the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country." Now that rest to my spirit has a meaning that is kind of different from what it is presented here, but we are going to discuss that. So what are these four horses or these four chariots? From Ezekiel chapter 6, verse 1 to 8, the same colors. Here they are chariots in Ezekiel, in Zechariah rather. Zechariah is what I meant. They are chariots in Revelation, they are actually horses, but they are the same colors, and there are four of them. Now in Zechariah it says they went out from mountains of bronze. Now why bronze? Now here is the issue about Bible prophecy. It always uses symbolism. There is no Bible prophecy without symbolism. Why? Because the people who were writing these things didn't know, were not supposed to understand some of the things. And God told Daniel as much, "You seal them up, you're not going to understand what you're writing." But the people who live in the time for which these things are prophesied will understand what you're writing. Now Daniel didn't understand any of those things. He's seeing beasts, he's seeing a lion, he's seeing a bear, he's seeing a leopard, okay? And all these have meanings which we now know, okay? We now know that, as I've discussed briefly earlier on, that a lion is the national symbol of Great Britain, and it's talking about the British Empire. Just like the leopard is for Germany, just like the bear is for Russia, okay? All these countries now have national symbols, just like the crested crane is for Uganda. Now, if he was prophesying about Uganda, he would say, "I saw a crested crane." Why is that? Because these countries had symbols. Now, of course, there was no such country as Britain or Germany or Russia at the time. And there is no way Daniel could have known what these are. However, the reason it uses animals and colors and metals is because those don't change. Daniel was prophesying 530 years before the birth of Christ. And a lion, 530 years BC, is a lion in 2014 AD, the year in which we are living. So why does he use symbolism? Because animals don't change, colors don't change, metals don't change. Gold then is gold now. There is nothing that has changed. Everything else has changed. The era has changed. The people have changed. There was no such thing. So God shows him Britain, but he shows him a lion. And he says, "You won't understand." Now me, who is living in this age, knows that a lion means Britain, because that's the national symbol of Britain. And he says these are kingdoms, these are empires. I'm just trying to explain to you why the Bible uses symbolism. Bronze that time is bronze today. Nothing has changed about bronze, neither has it about gold or silver or any of the other things. So the reason prophecy uses symbolism is because these symbols transcend generations. They do not stop at the generation of the people that prophesied them. Now all the other names, so many of the other things have changed. Of course, there are prophecies that are mentioned in names that existed at the time, especially places. But those we know, that if it says Constantinople, for instance, like it says somewhere, then we know Constantinople is actually Istanbul, Turkey, now. because the locations don't change, and we know where Constantinople is, and we know that's exactly where Istanbul is currently is. So places don't quite change, so they retain the names of Bach, but all the other symbols that of things coming ahead, of empires and what, it talks about the eagle, which we know is the national symbol of America, okay? And a beast with 10 horns, things which we are going to look at shortly as we continue with our study of Revelation. And they will suddenly make sense to you because you probably haven't read them that much, because what are four horses? I mean, what do four horses do? So I saw a man riding on a horse and what, and it doesn't really make sense. But now I'm good, that's why I'm here, to make you understand why, first of all, why he uses symbolism, but secondly, make you understand the meaning of all of this. Now, bronze, of course, has a biblical meaning, really, okay? And it's basically about a belief system, and all these four horses or chariots represent belief systems that propagated themselves for control, to control people through human effort. There were human spirits that used, you know, different belief systems, religious and economic belief systems, to control people. Now, bronze? Why were they coming out of bronze mountains? God, you know, these symbols. Gold is a symbol of divinity, really, divine strength and perfection. Silver is a symbol of redemption. Bronze is a symbol of effort. In this case, human effort. Why is that? Bronze and brass are almost the same. They are used almost interchangeably. Actually, they are the same metal. The difference is bronze is not pure. It's a bit of an alloy. I think bronze has a bit of iron. Now, brass is what is pure. Is what is what would you would call pure bronze? Okay, and is used. Bronze now is used when strength is required without the necessary value, because it's not of the same value as silver and gold. But even in building of the utensils in the temple and what, when they required power, I mean of the metallic strength, without the value, they used bronze. And the examples in the Bible show, I mean, the bronze serpent that Moses built turned out into a worship system. Eventually, it was destroyed by King Hezekiah, but they turned it into some kind of worship system. But generally, bronze represents a belief system, and propagated by effort, human effort. But then now that's why you see that in the book of Ephesians, when Paul is talking about the full armor of God, he says that shod your feet with the preparation to preach the gospel of peace. Now, the feet, of course, are representative of effort, because they are the ones that make you move. So shod your feet with the readiness or preparation to go and preach the gospel. Now, if you combine that with Revelation 1:13, where John saw Jesus, and he says his feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace. Now, Jesus' feet are not of bronze, because bronze is kind of impure. Now, brass is effort, but pure effort. That's why Jesus' feet are like fine brass, as if it has been refined in a furnace. Okay? A sign that his effort, because of course he had to move to go and, establish the kingdom, but his effort was perfect, and bronze has a bit of human element to it. So they are coming out of mountains of bronze. Now that's going to help you understand why. The whole point behind bronze and everything. Let's look at what these horses are. From the scriptures, we see the characteristics of the white horse. Let's start with the white horse. What does it represent? Now, from the scriptures we've read, both in Zechariah and Revelation, this is what it says about the white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, which is a symbol of conquest. A crown was given unto him, and he went on to conquer. Now, from Zechariah chapter 6, we see that he went to the north country, which is Europe, which is symbolic of Europe, the north country. Now, white, there is one belief system that is represented by white. White is the symbol of Catholicism, but more especially the papacy. The Pope, the papacy, is represented by the color white. And they went on to conquer the north country, the whole of Europe. Now, I've told you this when we were studying the church age, how Europe was subdued by the Catholic faith, and everybody was in absolute fear of the Pope. I told you how an emperor of Germany went to meet the Pope and stood outside of the Pope's palace, and they made him stand bare feet in snow for hours before the Pope would decide if he was going to meet him or not. Now that is an emperor. Now that's how powerful the Pope was. Now a crown was given to him, and he went and conquered the whole north country, which is symbolic of Europe. And so even up to now, actually, white is the symbol of the papacy. Now those who go and meet the Pope are not permitted to wear anything white in their attire, because white is him. Now actually, if you're a man, you're supposed, there's a specific dress code you have to adhere to if you're going to meet the Pope. It involves putting on basically like a suit, okay, and if you're a man, that is, and it has to be dark black preferably, but either way, very dark blue or black, something like that. It cannot be anything light. You cannot put on light blue or anything that is close to white. It has to be as dark as possible. And because he's the only one who is allowed to be in white during when he's giving audience to other people, and so everybody else must wear dark colors to demonstrate the contrast between the fact that you are apparently a sinner and he's pure. So even the Queen of England, who met him recently, had to request for permission to put on a light color, because she usually puts on like a light blue dress, but she had to be granted special permission from the Pope to put dress like that, because otherwise you have to go in what? In black. But even her couldn't put on white, but she put on something apart from black anyway, and she was she went and had audience with the Pope. So now I'm trying to show you that the white horse is the symbol of Catholicism, which came and conquered the earth at the time, the whole of Europe and much of the earth, except and actually had control over all the Christian lands, even outside of Europe, until of course the 6th century when Muhammad came and started uniting the Middle East and the Arabs under the umbrella of Islam. Now let's move to the second seal. When he opened the second seal, I had the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and the people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. Now, why a red horse? What is the meaning of a red horse? Red is the official color for communism. Every communist country, or even some socialist European countries, have red in their flags, because red is the official. That's why they say red China, okay, or red Russia, or red Romania, okay, or Bulgaria as it was before, because red is the official symbol for communism. I'm not giving you conjecture here. All these countries actually have their colors. Now John the apostle was seeing revolutions that would spread in the world before the coming of the Messiah, the second coming, that is. Now socialism, of course, the roots of communism were started by Karl Marx and his Marxism. Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto. He was the legendary German scholar who created some kind of revolution in thinking across Europe. But that was in the 19th century, from 18 something, and he wrote that famous Communist Manifesto. But the real communist revolution did not take place until Lenin in Russia, soon after the First World War. That's when it took effect. And it's important to know that it lasted from 1919 to 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell. That is exactly 70 years. Now that is significant. You will get to know why later on. So the red horse is communism, the white horse is Catholicism. Now the third seal talks about, when you open the third seal, I had the living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I had a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Notice that the man on the black horse does not go to fight. There is no war involved here, but he conquers, okay? Because all the horses go to conquer, and actually horses being a symbol of conquest. But here there is no mention of a bow, there is no mention of a sword or any such fighting thing. It is just holding a pair of scales. Scales, of course, are a symbol of commerce or trade. Okay. Now this horse, although it comes favorably, will by prophecy eventually cause great shortage. Now that's what we are going to talk about a bit later. Now the black horse is a symbol of capitalism. Okay. Capitalism does not, unlike communism, which spread through war. When the communist revolution took place, the Berlin Wall was built in 1961. Now, every time that any of the communist countries tried to move away from communism, it happened in Bulgaria, it happened in Romania, when they tried to vote more liberal, more central-leaning politicians into power to try and move away from the rigor of communism, the Russian tanks moved in and crushed everybody and restored communism back to where it was. They used force. Now, capitalism, by contrast, was a bit more subtle, and they used commerce, they used trade and a few other things. That's why this man is holding a pair of scales in his hand. He's not holding a bow, he's just using scales. Okay. And it represents capitalism. So, and commerce and trade are the underlying principles, really, of capitalism. Accounts are said to be in red because generally communist countries were broke throughout the time. I mean, those countries were really living in poverty, Romania, Bulgaria, and basically all of the communist Russia and what. Because they were generally broke, and the capitalist countries, even East Germany, and the capitalist countries were in prosperity, that's where you get the phrase, your account is in the red, meaning you have no money on your account. And if you have money, what do they say? Your account is in the black. Okay? That was some kind of demeaning capitalist mindset to show that their style brings prosperity and the communist style brings poverty, which actually is true. And so that's why they say an account is in the red, is always in the black, meaning there is the extra funds. And that capitalists love to associate themselves with that extra fund. But then it goes on to say, do not harm the oil and the wine. Oil and wine. What are oil and wine? Of course, the Bible speaks a lot about oil and wine, but not so much in this case as in what you'd think oil and wine mean. But if you read Psalms 104, verse 15, what does it say? And wine that makes glad the heart of man, and oil to make his face shine, and bread which strengthens a man's heart. Okay? And these oil and wine are generally symbols of well-being. Wine that makes the heart of man glad, and oil that makes his face shine. So, capitalist countries generally had a better standard of living than socialist countries. This is what this thing is saying a bit. But oil also describes power, both spiritual power, which is symbolized by the anointing oil and the anointing being similar, but also natural economic power, as it is in this case, which is also real oil as it is right now, petroleum oil, which is the biggest commodity on earth at present, because oil is used to power everything, virtually everything on earth, from the lanterns which your grandmother uses in the village, in the homes, to powering our cars, to powering big industries. So it's a symbol of power, and I don't think more wars are going to be fought over anything else than over oil. Now, if you combine these two things, a quart of wheat for a denarius, that means a day's meal for a day's wages. Now, that is a sign, not of prosperity as capitalism claims, but of penury. Really, you're working to feed yourself, that's it. So a day's wages is a denarius, and a quart of wheat is what you need to eat a day. Now, that means that there's going to be food shortage. There's going to be shortage generally, because if all the money you're working for is used to buy food, then you're in serious trouble, because how are you going to buy other things? How are you going to educate your children and what? And yet you cannot go on to education until you fed them, because feeding is more important than education. Now, how do those people measure the class of a society? By how much, what percentage of your income you use to buy food. Now, they will say, let's say in societies like Uganda, 50% of our income is used to buy food. But in more advanced societies, you'll find that probably even 5% is used to buy food. The rest is used to buy luxurious things, holidays, plane tickets and what. So now here, you see a scenario where 100% of somebody's income is used actually to buy food. Now that's a bad thing. But it says, but do not harm the oil and the wine. So what does that mean? On the one hand, some people are working hard only for a ration of food a day. On the other hand, those who are powerful and luxurious are not touched. That is, the oil and the wine is not touched. That is how capitalism works eventually. Now, you might not see the thing about it, but there was a meeting of the richest countries in the world and the richest men, and talking about income redistribution recently. And things like in Switzerland, talking about things like income redistribution, how the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer, and how this balance can be addressed. And I was listening to it on TV, and a gentleman says it's just they are not there discussing that. That's the theme of the conference, but he actually described it as people partying at the mountaintop, while the rest of the people in the valleys are starving. And that's precisely what it is, and that's precisely where capitalism eventually heads. Now, that's the third seal. The fourth seal, what does it say? It's called, when you open the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name who sat on it was called Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth, to kill with a sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. Now, I want you to know one thing, that here the Bible talks about a pale horse, okay? But the word used there is actually chloros. Chloros. The Greek word which they translate as pale is actually chloros. And the actual meaning of chloros is green. And it's not used only there in the New Testament. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 31, when Mark 6:39, when Jesus was going to feed the 5,000, he commanded them to sit in groups on the green grass. Now, the word used there is chloros, green grass, and it's translated as green. Now, when you look in Luke 23 and 31, for if they do those things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? Then, again, it uses chloros, is the word used, and it's translated as green. Even in the book of Revelation, talking about the first trumpet, it says the first angels sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burnt up, and all the green grass was burnt up, all the chloros grass was burnt up. Then also in Revelation chapter 9, again you see the word chloros appearing, and it's translated as green. So why does the word chloros here, talking about the fourth horse, why did the translators call it a pale horse, yet the word used is chloros? I'll tell you why. Because the translators of the Bible were told, look for what makes meaning, what has a meaning. Because languages differ. You cannot translate a language word for word and you get the meaning. Okay? You translate the context. Okay? So they read what is said in Greek and they understand Greek and they translate what it means in English. It doesn't have to come out word for word. So they were told to translate in as much as it makes sense. Now, a green horse does not make sense because nobody has seen a green horse. There is no such thing as a green horse. So when the translators come upon a man riding a chloros horse. Chloros is where we get so many words in English. Chloro something, meaning green. Okay, referring to plants and everything. Chloro. We English borrowed almost a big percentage of their vocabulary from Greek. And it's where they get chloro something, chloro, you know, meaning green, or gotten from green things, or herbal, or things like that. Now, the green horse, nobody knows a green horse. I mean, what's a green horse? So they said, what's the closest to green that a horse can be? Okay? So they came up with a pale horse. But the reality is actually it is a green horse. Okay? The word used there is chloros, which is used 5 other times in the Bible and or in the New Testament. And all those times it's translated as green. So I just had to explain that to you. So what are the characteristics of the man riding on a green horse now that we know that it was green? his death and Hades followed him. He took control over a fourth of the earth. He captured the southern country, which is the Middle East, Egypt downwards. He killed with a sword, hunger, death, and by beasts. Of course, I'm sure you can guess what that is. The green horse is Islam. Green is the official color of Islam. And it has actually been since Muhammad wrote about his meeting, his alleged meeting with the angel Gabriel. And Muhammad claims that when he saw the angel Gabriel and the sky around him turned green, and he claims the angel Gabriel is the one who gave him the message on which Islam is built. And he said the sky around him turned from blue to green. So green has always been considered to be the color of Islam, and is. I mean, almost all Islamic countries have green in their flags, the Green Revolution and what. And now the interesting thing is that when the Arab Spring happened, there was a picture which was taken of people who were protesting in Tahrir Square in Cairo. And something extraordinary happened on the pictures of all news channels. Somewhere in a very light way, on live camera pictures, there appeared a man riding on a green horse. And it is there. If you don't believe me, go to YouTube, okay, and fill in those words, you will see it. And you will get footage from CNN, not from Christian channels. From CNN, from Sky News, from Al Jazeera, all everywhere, because all the cameras were there. And somewhere in the background, almost in a hazy thing, there appears a man riding a green horse, and it lasts for about 3 or 4 seconds, then he disappears. And it shocked everybody. But you know, that's precisely it, Islam, and you know the birth. So the man riding on a green horse. So the fourth beast represents Islam. Okay? Death and heads follow him. Of course, we know there is a way. I mean, Islam celebrates death, and Muslims always find something to kill people about, including killing fellow Muslims. Right now in Iran, in Iraq and Syria, there is a battle going on between Sunnis and Shias. Now these are both Muslims, they both believe in Muhammad, they both believe in almost all the doctrines of Islam, but they just differ in small things. But still, and the Sunnis are the majority of Muslims in the world, they're about 85%. Shias are only like 15%, but still they find something to kill each other about. Okay, Sunnis believe, here is the big difference between them. Sunnis believe that Abu Bakr, the father of Muhammad's wife Aisha, was Muhammad's rightful successor, and that the method of choosing or electing leaders, or the shura, which is endorsed by the Quran, is the consensus by the Ummah or the Muslim community. Now the Shias believe Muhammad divinely ordained his cousin and son-in-law Ali, who is the father of his grandsons, Hassan ibn Ali and Hussein ibn Ali, in accordance with the command of God to be the next caliph, making Ali and his direct descendants Muhammad's successors. Now Ali was married to Fatima, Muhammad's daughter, and he was Muhammad's distant relative, and he was married to Muhammad's daughter, okay, called Fatima. And the Shias claim that Muhammad handed the reins, the caliph, to him. Now that's what the Shias believe. The Sunnis believe that he gave it to who? To Abu Bakr, who was the father of his youngest wife Aisha. Now that's the difference, really. Do you know when that happened? 632 AD. But since then, Shias and Muslims and Sunnis have still found something to kill each other. As that's why it says the name of him who sat on it was death, and heads followed him. I mean, the whole thing of Islam glorification of death. You know, you go to heaven if you die killing Christians or die killing Jews and what. It's all embedded in the foundation of it. Okay, and you can't take death away from Islam, and it remains what it is. Somehow they glorify it more than they seem to glorify life and everything, and it's a small thing, they take it so lightly, which of course is not how many other people think. But I'm just trying to tell you. And then here it also says the person riding the green horse was given power to take over a fourth of the world, fourth of the earth. Now that's amazing, because the population of Muslims is currently about 1.8 billion in the world, which is about one quarter of the total population of the world currently. Now, that's about one fourth, as the Bible says here. So, now you know. It's actually slightly less, it's about 24%, but it is going to be 25% at the time when some of these things happen. And of course, it's increasing every time. It's projected to be over 30% by 2030. But it will be 25% way before 2030, and that is when a lot of these things are going to work. So, Muhammad died in 632 AD at the age of 62, and Islam continued its wars of conquest since then. Okay? That's why it says he was given power to kill many. By what? By the sword, by famine, by pestilence, okay? And by wild beasts. With the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the wild beasts. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth. That's Revelations 6:8, okay? And power was given to them, the man who rides the fourth, or the fourth green horse, to kill with over a fourth of the earth. That's a fourth of the population of the earth, which currently is, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beasts of the earth. So basically, Islam spread through war. That was it. When Muhammad went and somehow united the Arabs, who were divided along tribal lines, tribal, clan, and what, he united them under Islam. Before he died, he promised Christians and Jews and all idol worshippers, people who had their traditional beliefs, that even under the Islamic, you know, country, they will be safe and everything. But they were not. Those who didn't convert were killed. And that's what happened elsewhere. So he spread after that. He died in 632 AD. 637, that's when the most of the holy war started. They conquered Syria. 2 years later, Armenia. Now this is even in current, like, you know, Soviet, whatever. They conquered Egypt, of course. They conquered most of North Africa. That's by 20 years after Muhammad's death, North Africa had been conquered. Then they went into Europe, into Cyprus. Okay? Then they conquered after North Africa. Then they moved to Constantinople, which is Istanbul. 98% of Turks are Muslims, because they conquered all of Turkey. Then they conquered Istanbul again after it had been reconquered. Then Hispania. They actually went even Spain and Portugal. But the Pope had to mobilize forces to come and unconquer those parts of Europe which were being conquered. They were determined to go the way they conquered the south of Italy in 827 AD. So, and here's the thing, where the Muslims conquer, they give you a chance to convert and leave. If you don't convert, you die. Either they starve you, the Bible says, by hunger, or they would feed them to wild beasts, which also Catholics were doing at the time, killing so-called heretics, feeding them to the beasts. So they just copied what the Christians were doing, and they would feed them to the beasts, the way the emperors of Rome used to feed Christians to lions. So that's basically how they killed so many of them. They would feed them to animals, and the Bible is so clear about that. So now, you know the four horses. The first four horses are Catholicism, Communism, Capitalism, and Islam. Okay, now we go to the fifth seal, and we get over this very quickly. Then he opened the fifth seal, and I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Then a white robe was given to them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who were to be killed as they were was completed. Now the fifth seal, we know the fourth seal has happened. The fifth seal, we don't know if it has happened, because there is no corresponding sign on earth to show that the sixth seal has been opened. Now, rather the fifth seal. Now the sixth seal is actually the rapture. So now we might actually be between the fifth and the sixth seal, which I believe we are. And the sixth seal is the rapture. How do I know that? I'll read for you. "And I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of the heaven fell to the earth, as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave, every free man, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Now this is a description of what the Bible calls the day of the Lord. Now this same thing which happens on the sixth seal is also precisely what happens on the seventh trumpet. The description of what happens is the same. The sixth seal and the seventh trumpet. Of course, we are yet to talk about trumpets, but that is coming up next. Now, the seventh trumpet is the last trumpet. And the book of 1 Corinthians 52-53 tells us that we shall not all die, we shall be changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, at the sounding of the last trumpet. Now, the trumpets are mentioned in Revelation, and the seventh trumpet is the last trumpet. What happens when the seventh trumpet is sounded? The rapture. We are changed in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, and we are carried up from this earth and go up to meet Jesus in the clouds. Now, the things that happened before then are described here in the sixth seal. Now, when the sixth seal happens, the rapture happens. We might be past the fifth seal, we might not be. The fifth seal does not have any symbol that is earthly. The first four, all of them have earthly symbols. The fifth one, that happens in heaven, where we are not. The day of the Lord. What is the day of the Lord? It is described in so many parts of the Bible. The sky and the heavens roar away, and the earth trembles. It's called the day of the Lord. Matthew 24:29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. The day of the Lord. And we've read it in Revelation 6, which is the sixth seal. In Joel chapter 2, verse 30 and 31, I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. Those words again, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. Description of the day. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger. We read, that's now I'm reading from Isaiah chapter 13, verse 9 to 10. Cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not give light, and the sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not rise, will not cause its light to shine. The day of the Lord. Even 2 Peter talks about it, chapter 3 and verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burnt up. Now, what is one of the biggest issues we have here? But maybe I'll tell you this also. Also, Hebrews talks about it. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 10 to 12. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. And they will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak, you will fold them up. Okay? Now it says the sky will recede, and the heavens will roar away. And here it says you will fold them up, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and yours will not fail. Now here it's a description of what happens on the day of the Lord. Because in Revelation chapter 6, when we're talking about the sixth seal, it actually says the sky recedes, is rolled away, and people can see what is above it. Now, one of the biggest problems is people have the impression that the rapture is going to happen in a quiet way. People are silently taken out of the way, and people wake up in the morning and wow, so and so has gone. Okay, but that is not going to be the case, because Jesus actually said, like the lightning strikes from east to west and everybody sees, so shall be the day of the coming of the Son of Man. Because it's going to be very clear, and everybody will know what is happening, and the stars of the heaven will fall. Heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken. Then the sky is receded like a scroll, or more or less folded up, as Hebrews says, folded up as a scroll when it is rolled. and every mountain and every island is moved out of its place. Now that is a day of great different things. Now here is what is going to happen. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, I'm actually reading from Matthew now, chapter 24, verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Okay? Now this talks about what happens after that. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather his elect from the four winds of the earth, from the four winds, from one end to the other. Okay. Now, what happens at the time of the revelation? We've talked about this, rapture, we've talked about this before actually. What happens is the sky recedes. People see signs in the heavens and in the earth. You've heard about the blood moons. Now that is like a preamble. Now you see the sky, people see the sky receding and they can more or less see heaven from earth. The sky is rolled away and then they see the Son of Man coming down. Then those who believe in him, for those who believe in him, it will be a time of great rejoicing, because then they will be picked up. Their bodies will be changed from the mortal bodies that they currently have to immortal bodies that are eternal and that are heavenly bodies. And then they will be lifted up and meet Christ in the air. Now those who have not believed in him will flee under the mountains and ask the mountains to fall on them, because they will fear, what do they say? Because the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand it? And it says free, kings, nobles, slaves, free, rich, poor, all of them who do not believe in him. Now it's going to be a great day of rejoicing for some people and a great day of torment for other people, depending on which side you stand. Now that is how it is going to happen. That is at the sixth seal. Now that is the end of Revelation chapter 6. The seventh seal happens later on in Revelation chapter 8. Why? Because in chapter 7 it describes the things that happened there. First of all, they will seal the people of Israel, the natural Israel, who will not have believed, will be sealed with a seal, 144,000 of them. Then I'm just giving you a preamble of what we are going to talk about. We're going to talk about next time. 144,000 of them. You've read that in the book of Revelation. I hope you are reading the book just like I told you to read it. And those will not be the only Jews who are saved, like people think. People say, you mean only 144,000 Jews are going to be saved? No, that is not true. Those are going to be witnesses to the rest of the Jews for the final 3.5 years of the tribulation. Because this day of the Lord happened somewhere in the middle of the tribulation, according to my theology. Okay? According to what I believe and according to all the scriptures that I've read and all the positions I've put together, and this fits perfectly into all scripture. Now for the final 3.5 years, the 144,000 will minister to the fellow Jews, okay? And there will be a special dispensation for Jews to protect them. Now we'll talk about that when we get to Revelation chapter 12. And they will be protected in that time. Jesus said they should run from one city to the other. And by the time they are through with the cities of Israel, the Lord will have come back. Then he said, these days were shortened for the sake of the elect, the Jews, because the whole world will be against the Jews in that time. Now, what are we waiting for? I told you, before all of these things happen, before the sixth seal, before the rapture, there has to be the 7-year agreement between Israel and Palestine. Now, that is coming very close. That is really close. The Bible talks about a war that will break out in the Euphrates. We are going to talk about that when we get to that chapter of Revelation that breaks out on the river Euphrates. Now the countries that are covered at the river Euphrates are Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Turkey. And Syria is in war right now. Iraq is in war right now. Iran is there and thereabout. Not quite in war, but not far from it either. And Turkey has been getting itself into all sorts of tight positions right now and turning towards its Islamic nature rather than its European nature. That's why the European Union has been very worried about including Turkey, into their European Union, because they are too Muslim. They are they don't trust them to be part of the European Union, because of course European Union gives you privileges. You can move to any part of the Union and settle there. Now, if they have the big population of Turkey, which is 99% Muslims, as part of the European Union, then they can go and settle across Europe. And, well, you know, they want to take over Europe. That's the idea. And nobody wants them to. At least the Europeans don't. Although it might be too late for them, because already countries like France, Muslims are too many. And now they are killing Jews. And now so many Jews. I posted actually something on my Facebook page about how Jews are losing the public opinion war. The Presbyterian Church in America voted to divest, to remove their divestiture from companies that do business with Jewish communities, because apparently the Jews are tormenting the Palestinians. Okay. Now, recently you heard about the three teenagers who were picked up by Palestinians and they were found dead. Now, Israel has retaliated with serious strikes and is going to kill a number of people as a way of retaliation. And now that is going to be constituted by the media. And even so many people who listen to the media today find themselves getting a natural anger for Israel, because the media is on an agenda to turn the world community against Israel. And who is in charge of that agenda? Of course, it's the devil. People don't understand that the devil has a big say in all of this, because all the people, I told you the other day about the Bilderbergs, the richest, most powerful men in the world who meet every year, all of them are they are very, very big, you know, devil worshippers in one way or the other, members of secret societies and what, and they decide the agenda of the world. So if you consume everything you're given, I see even some of our journalists here, including columnists, including John Nagenda. You know, he writes all the time, Israel is doing this and Israel. And he doesn't even know the facts. He's just getting what is being fed to him by the British media. And where do all these opinions come from? And until our people know how to have an opinion that is independent of the news, because the news is agenda. And I told you this before. When the anti-homosexuality bill was signed, I watched CNN and they were talking absolute lies, 100% lies, creating a picture that homosexuals are being burnt on the street, police is moving from house to house, pulling people out suspected of being homosexuals, and basically slaying them with machetes. That's the picture that was created. Is it true? No. Of course, they were talking about Kampala, a city in which I live. But why do they say that? They are creating an agenda. And until you understand that almost 70% of the news you watch on your news channels, especially the international ones, is agenda. They are trying to get you to believe something. And 30% is news. Even the news is quoted to present a certain agenda. Until you understand that, you'll be caught into, now I'm appealing, I'm talking to certain people, you'll be caught into emotions. You know, the Israelites are tormenting the Palestinians. But the Palestinians have more than once come out and said Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth. So what are we going to do with 9 million Jews? Well, if you ask the Palestinians, just kill all of them. So you think Israel is supposed to shut up and they get killed to please certain so-called international community headed by a Muslim called Barack Obama? It's not going to happen. It is not going to happen. I mean, the other day I was listening to Obama basically slaying the Bible, saying what kind of God goes and tells, you know, what you tell the children, Joshua and the children of Israel, kill everybody, including children and what. And he turns it and gets it and turns it and actually turns it all around. And they don't even understand the context. But you know, they turn it. And of course, the other day we were celebrating Obama president. I wish I'd known what kind of president he was going to be. Sometimes I even feel guilty. Almost I had to repent for ever being happy that Obama was president. Because the man, the things the man is spreading across the earth. I mean, evil from beginning to end. Absolute evil. Okay? And now, of course, they have gotten into journalists who are told, you know, you won't travel for conferences and things like that unless you toe this line. So you have to accept, you know, homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle. Otherwise, you're not going to go to America. Oh, my God. And there are so many people, if you give up your conscience, well, you can get rich, because there is money to spread evil. By the way, there is a lot of money to spread evil. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because it is for a short time. the coming of the Lord is soon. Those who take that line will soon be hiding under mountains and saying, hide us from the whom sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Now those who choose the way of Jesus Christ will be celebrating when that day happens, and it is not far away from now. Okay, it isn't far away from now. So choose the way that ends up on the winning side, which is the way of Jesus Christ. Now I just want to remind you, if you want to become a partner with me and join me up, I've told you that before, just send me an email. The email address is ugandanwatchman@gmail.com. If you feel that what we are speaking here is, well, good and of God and should be spread, send me an email. Tell me that you want to become a partner. So many people have said as it is, and I'm expecting others to send. You can send me an email, even ask me questions. Maybe one day I'll answer all the questions that you people have been asking me on email about the end time message. At the beginning, I didn't want to answer them because they're a bit shallow. People hadn't yet understood the message, hadn't yet understood the subject. But now I am seeing the questions are becoming more based on knowledge because people are learning the subject of the end time. So now send me those questions. I will answer them on email and possibly even on air. Okay? Or you can post on my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Ugandan Watchman. Just that, and you go straight to that page. Post anything there, give your comments, and read what is on the page. And I'll be putting up some other things, including the things we studied today from the book of Revelation. If you want to know which scriptures I've been reading from, you can pick it up from the Facebook page. If you are not on the winning side of Jesus Christ, now is the time to accept the Lord Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. That is one thing you will never regret. If you go with the world and the worldly opinion and the opinions of the world that are getting evil every second, you will soon regret it. Good evening.
That was The Watchman with fascinating insight into the end times. Join us again next week for another update on Bible prophecy.